Our first reading this morning is from the Reverend Susan McGinn. She was minister here in Portland at White East for a while. You are not alone, dear one. You are among all those who have walked this straining path before. You are not alone. You are with the wisdom of all your ancestors who live, if nowhere else, in the cells of your body and your breath, remembering you from the very beginning. You are not alone. You are with us. You are right there, smiling and shining upon you like starlight, holding and surrounding you in silence and song, forever renewing our faith in you. Our second reading is from Abraham Lincoln. I have been driven many times upon my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I had nowhere else to go. My own wisdom and that of all about me seemed insufficient for the day. So in about 3 weeks, I am very fortunate in that I'm going to go to Australia. My son is living there with his wife while she goes to graduate school. And so I'm going to go mostly to visit them and to see a bit of the country. And so to prepare myself to go there, I listened to the book In a Sunburnt Country by Bill Bryson. And I love Bill Bryson. He is really smart and he's super funny. And he manages in this book to put a lot of Australian culture, history, geography, ecology, zoology, into a book that reads like a description of a very ill-planned trip featuring a great deal of beer drinking and bad hotels. And I learned a lot about Australia I had no idea about. It is indeed a strange and sunburnt country. They have found there species that everyone had thought had gone extinct, like in the time of the dinosaurs or even eons and eons before that. The first form of life who ever lived on Earth, which we thought had been extinct for billions of years, actually is in Australia. So that's amazing, right? But as I was listening to this book, I also came to understand the meaning of white-centered, which is a new word you hear a lot in anti-racism, anti-oppression work. White-centered simply means that stories and situations or worship services are told from a white perspective. And you can have stories that are wealthy-centered or male-centered or female-centered or black-centered or Latino-centered. But people in privileged positions in cultures nearly always center their own stories. Other people are always referred to in their relationship to the privileged. Bryson's book was about the Western explorers who discovered Australia and what Westerners have discovered about and done in that place ever since. He does talk about the Aborigines, but so briefly. He tells a little bit about how the people who are the ancestors of the current Aborigines came there 50,000 years ago. And he tells just the tiniest bit about their culture before the invasion. But everything he shared was based on the research of Western scientists. He did spend a lot more time on the simply horrific treatment of the indigenous by Western settlers, basically genocide and near annihilation of their culture. But even here, it is distressed white people of the 20th century who tell that story. In Bryson's book, the voices of the Aborigine themselves are silent. This all caused me to become a distressed white person, and I went to the internet to find out more about the original people of Australia. I found mostly Western white sources, of course, but there was a National Geographic article where the writer did talk to Aboriginal people, and their voices were in the story. I was complaining about this to someone and was told to watch the movie Rabbit Proof Fence. Well, directed by a white man and produced by white people, the film did center an Aboriginal story and was based on a book by an Aboriginal writer. And it is the story of her mother and aunt when they were children, and she interviewed both of them extensively. In Australia, from 1910 to 1970, the government removed Aboriginal children from their families and put them in camps and schools to teach them how to be white so that they could then work as menial laborers in white communities. The stated goal was to assimilate the Aboriginal people, either through die-out, which it actually said, or through intermarriage until everyone had pale skin. In the movie, the girls were taken from their mother. They fight the large white man like fierce cats, but are overcome and stuffed into a car. Their mother writhes on the ground in pain, and she and the other women wail as the girls are driven away. They are taken 1,500 miles away to a harsh camp run by nuns and government officials. The girls escape. And while they are chased by police and trackers, two of them manage to get all the way home. They walked all the way home, where they, with their relatives, escape into the desert. While that practice officially ended in 1970, the personal and cultural trauma still reverberates through the Aboriginal culture. Today, the government still takes away Aboriginal children from their parents, citing child neglect and abuse. It's about 35% these days. And just last month in The Guardian, the head of an Aboriginal nonprofit lashed out at how the government refuses to care for children in culturally competent ways and to follow best practices for strengthening traumatized families, so that after years of having that parenting-child bond broken, they can learn to parent again. And just to give you a little perspective, the Australians probably learned that from us here in the United States. Here, assimilating Indigenous people by taking children and putting them in boarding schools to teach them white ways started in the 1600s, and it was strongly advocated for by George Washington. And most boarding schools in this country were not shut down till the 1990s. And Native Americans to this day experience that same cultural and personal devastation and trauma as the Aborigines throughout that boarding school process. So I watched Rabbit Proof Fence and did this research just as reports about Senator Jeff Merkley's visit to the detention centers in Texas surfaced on social media, and finally, mainstream media. He reported seeing children, many of them taken from their parents, in wire enclosures like dog kennels in a warehouse. They had only space blankets to cover themselves and bare floor beneath. My understanding is that the children stay in that facility for just a few days or a few weeks and then are turned over to HHS. Merkley was unable to see the conditions in the HHS facility, an old Walmart that contains, according to reports, 1,000 children. Very few who have tried have been able to get inside. According to a lawyer who has been inside similar facilities, they usually include rooms of bunk beds and classrooms where children learn English and other basic education. It sounds very much like the boarding schools featured in Rabbit Proof Fence. Basic physical needs are dealt with: shelter, clothing, sleep, food. But children need much more than basic needs to survive or to flourish. I imagine that every child in there is traumatized, whether they came alone or with parents, or were separated. Separation is traumatizing. So is running from violence and starvation with your families. Descriptions of parents and children torn apart at the border are replays of that scene in Rabbit Proof Fence. The circumstances are different, but the underlying system is the same. White Western governments controlling and traumatizing brown people through child and parent separation. It is horrific. It is violent. It is meant to cause terror. And it is against every Unitarian Universalist value. Our theme this month is wisdom. Last week we heard wisdom from some of Wolf's beloved elders. After the service today at 1 p.m., an immigration lawyer will come to speak to us about the thorny details of immigration law and why people cross without proper papers or show up at the border seeking asylum instead of doing that from their own countries. A while ago, I had decided today to talk on wisdom and immigration and perhaps the wisdom of immigrants. And then I watched Rabbit Proof Fence, and Senator Jeff Merkley went to Texas to highlight the new policy of the Trump administration to process every asylum seeker and other border crosser as criminals, and as part of the process to take their children from the parents. Then on Thursday, ICE attacked a garden center in Ohio, bringing 200 officers, dogs and helicopters and guns to arrest 114 unarmed, nonviolent working people at gunpoint. Most were undocumented. Some were American citizens. They were arrested and shipped away from their city to be detained and processed elsewhere so they could not have visitors from their family or friends. Their children were left at daycare and at school. It doesn't take 200 officers, guns, dogs, helicopters to detain 114 nonviolent people. The point of that is terror. And it worked. Latino neighborhoods emptied as people went into hiding. Then on Thursday, we found out that 1,600 detainees from the border would be shipped to federal prisons throughout the United States. Yesterday, 123 men were brought to the Sheraton Minimum Security Prison, about an hour and a half to the southwest of here. We don't know much about them yet, but we do know some were separated from their children and their spouses and other family members. These people are not criminals. They simply asked for asylum. That is what they are supposed to do. This is in no way a crime. In August, the UN denounced the U.S. for the practice of detaining those who ask for asylum, saying that it violated international law. Others crossed the border without papers, which is the legal equivalent to a parking ticket. These practices are exactly like those of having someone come to the police to report that they are being stalked, or having someone who wrongly parked, forgot to pay a meter, to a minimum security prison where they are told they must wait indefinitely until authorities can pay attention to their case. This is for our government convenience or punishment or terror. The truth is, ICE has been separating families for years. It's usually done when undocumented or living and working in here and are taken and sent back to the countries they came from. So that's not new. And unaccompanied minors have been warehoused with silver space blankets under other administrations, including the Obama administration. Things have seriously escalated, however. Routine separation of families at the border began just weeks ago. Military-like raids on workplaces is new. Putting detainees in prison is new. And it is horrific. So I have no idea why I turned on The Royal Wedding a few weeks ago. I hadn't followed the romance at all. I didn't even know that Meghan was an actress or that she was half black. But for some reason, I turned it on that Saturday morning to watch with my coffee. And I was instantly enthralled in that fairy tale royal wedding with that horse and carriage and that beautiful dress and the cathedral and all the flower girls. What I wasn't prepared for, what had me at the edge of my seat, was the sermon by Bishop Michael Curry, an African-American bishop of the Episcopal Church. It was completely disorienting. Was this really an African-American bishop quoting Martin Luther King Jr. to the Queen of England and the royal elite? I even stopped the YouTube video and rewound it, thinking I must have got something wrong here, but I had got it right. Was this man actually bringing up moments of American slave culture to the descendants of the people who colonized most of the world, killing millions and millions of black and brown people on continent after continent, taking their children away from their parents, instituting white supremacist culture in country after country throughout this world? Nearly half the world's population was watching that wedding, watching a descendant of slaves preach to the descendants of the very people who made the slavery of his ancestors in the United States possible. This was completely surreal. Without apology, without blinking, Curry leapt from the love of two very privileged adults to the transformative love at the heart of liberal Christianity. He preached the love of Martin Luther King Jr. He preached the love that is the root of Unitarian Universalism. He said of this radical love, "I'm talking about power, real power, power to change the world." Imagine, he asked his listeners, a world where love was the way, in families, in government, in businesses. Imagine a world transformed by love, he said over and over. Imagine a world where love is the way. Humans harnessed fire, he reminded us. Learning to use fire made civilization and technology possible. It made our cell phones possible, and it made his flight across the Atlantic possible. Fire changed the world in the ways that those earliest humans could not have imagined. Then Curry asked, imagine a fire of love. If humans harnessed love the way we have harnessed fire, what would be possible? What would be possible? What would our world be if it was on fire with love? Just like those long ago humans who cooked meat over a fire for the first time could not imagine a modern city, I can't imagine a world on fire with love. We would create systems, I imagine, where all people could flourish and all species could flourish. But what would that look like? What would that be? I don't know. Bishop Curry used the love between two adults as a jumping off place to talk about religious love, redemptive love, love for all. The more primal love, though, is the love between a parent and a child. That love connects us in a way where we can't stop it, either as a parent or as a child. That is a love that we yearn for, even when the love goes wrong, even when the relationship is a mess, even when it feels unfixable and impossible. Parent and child love is the deepest connection of our souls and our hearts and our bodies. It is a love that does not let us go. Imagine the world on fire with that kind of love. Imagine the world on fire with a love that does not ever let us go. So people squabble about the meaning of the word wisdom. Psychologists, Christians, Buddhists, Australian Aborigines, and others all have different nuances on what it is and its importance in our lives and how we achieve it. But basically, wisdom means knowing the right thing to do. American psychologists say wisdom is expertise in dealing with the difficult questions of life. The Buddhists say it means seeing reality clearly. The Australian Aborigines have a practice of deep listening known as Dadiri. Wisdom comes from this deep listening. It connects a person to the divine, which is both the world and beyond the world. In the Jewish and Christian traditions, there is an addition of doing the right thing. The Buddhists would not disagree with that, and I don't think the Australian Aborigines would either. Personally, I always imagine wisdom as calm. It's unruffled. The wise never seem to break a sweat. Just think about Gandalf or Dumbledore or Yoda or Princess Leia in the last Star Wars movie. Wisdom does not make a big fussy fit, to quote Ramona Quimby, the spunky heroine of Ramona the Pest. The wise do get angry in a eyes flashed with anger sort of way, but they don't seem to rage. Our government is tearing families and communities apart. They do this at the border. They do this in our neighborhoods. They have started doing this in the place where we conduct business. The government has legal reasons for this. People should not cross borders, they say. They must be deterred. They must be processed. They must be punished. These borders were created, by the way, through wars and invasions. When governments attack the least among us, they always have laws, or at least they have some administrative procedures. Colonization was legal because European Christian countries created a legal standing, now called the Doctrine of Discovery. In about 1500, they wrote up something that said, if a European Christian person discovered some land that another European Christian person hadn't discovered before, they could have it, regardless of who lived there. And that was a law with administrative procedures that, like genocide and parent-child separation. Jewish people and other marginalized people in Germany were made illegal. There was a law. When a government controls and terrorizes, they always create reasons bound up in laws and administrative procedures and government bureaucracy. Wisdom asks us what is the right thing to do. So does radical, transformative love. Why do the wise seem so calm? I believe it's because they know the right thing to do. They know what they have to do. Perhaps they don't rage because they spend their energy doing what they have to do. And doing that is difficult enough. And I believe that we know what we have to do. We don't know if we'll be successful. We don't know if we can stop our government from terrorizing the least among us. But we do know the right thing to do. We have to say no, loudly, firmly, clearly, over and over. We have to say no with our hearts, with our mouths, in writing, in social media, and with our bodies. We have to ask our friends to say no. We need to find others who are saying no and make a team with them. We have to say no in the public square and in the media. We have to advocate for laws that will change this. And we have to insist that these laws are passed and they are enforced. Will we win? will we deter the power of the U.S. government to continue a centuries-old practice of destroying brown and black families? I do not know that. I know, however, that it matters. I know that standing for love now creates a bridge for others to build on in our long quest to build a world on fire with love, a world where every single person and species can flourish. To watch a child and mother torn apart and do nothing is against our very nature. We have all been children, and we have all loved children. To watch and do nothing damages and twists our souls and our hearts. It turns us bitter and angry and hopeless and apathetic. We know the right thing to do. We have to get educated. We have to make calls and write letters and sign petitions. We have to post on social media. And instead of asking our friends out to lunch, ask them to the protest at the ICE Center in Portland or the prison in Sheridan. Register voters. Get out the vote. Say no. When people first harnessed the power of fire, they could not have imagined an airplane. During the Civil War, neither the free nor the slave could have imagined that the descendants of a slave would one day preach at the wedding of the descendants of the King of England. We cannot imagine a world on fire with love now, but we can stand for love, and we can fight for love, and we can say yes to love over and over. We can do that. We can stand for love over and over until things start blazing.
Thank you, Tracy. That was really wonderful. And it reminded me of a conference I was fortunate to get to go to in Coos, Switzerland about 10 years ago. And it was addressing what cities and countries were doing about racism. And there were two representatives from Australia. One was a white man who led the drive to get signatures to say to have National Sorry Day, and they got millions, far more signatures than they ever imagined. The Prime Minister was totally against it until he saw how many signatures they got. And then the other man was Aborigines. He was probably in his 50s or early 60s. His wife could not get up there and speak, but he told about how when his parents were out doing whatever, and they were very isolated, if a car drove up, the kids were to grab the baby and run and hide. And one day, they missed seeing the car in time. And so they ran without the baby and hid, and the baby was taken. And he said that young brother never forgave them.
I'd like to speak for just a minute about the trauma to kids in my CASA work. Out of the 6 kids I've had so far, 3 have been diagnosed with significant PTSD, and not a one of them has been older than 6. So, and this is, I take lots of classes and things like that, and teachers do now. Everything has to change because we have these little people who can't even learn to tie their shoes because they are so traumatized. So look at all the things that little kids have to learn. And it isn't happening because they can't get over this. So here we are thinking about all these kids that are being warehoused wherever they are. And we're just ruining another generation. It's just awful.
Just the act of doing it is,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it goes on for a long time.
Yeah, so be rabidly cheesed off, people.
I would encourage anybody, if you're going to see Rabbit Proof Fence, I found it very powerful to watch it 3 times. The first time, just straight through. The second, DVDs are always full of the director's notes and the making of, and sometimes they just become other movies. But the making of this movie is a powerful story in itself. While it was a white director, he was trying to preserve as much as he could of the Aboriginal style. He recruited 3 kids who had no acting ability, but they were Aborigines, because he felt it was more important to have the Aborigine tell the story. So his experience of running into the cultural trauma that he had no idea of, when the filming of the kids being taken, he was ready to go on because, okay, good, cut, let's move on. And he watched all of these Aborigine people curled up, shaken. And he realized he had to stop and pause. And it was something he had no understanding of. So I do encourage people, and then to watch the third time around and hear the over voices. The most powerful message I heard from that was Kenneth Branagh stating in his character how much his character, that white bureaucrat who justified taking these children away, and his belief that this was for the greater good of these children. And that, I felt, was a very powerful message in itself. How many times have we done things that we are lying to ourselves, are for the greater good, or we're fooling ourselves and we don't know enough? And it's very easy for me to point fingers and say, how could you possibly believe that could be good? But then I, in turn, have to look at myself, at maybe I'm having some beliefs that I think are for the greater good, and I'm naive and shutting myself off. So
clearly it's essential that we demonstrate disapproval of what's going on. But something more needs to be done. And I think it's this. Every decision maker in the current administration involved in this program needs to be put on notice that once a sane administration comes into power, we will demand that they be extradited to The Hague to stand trial for crimes against humanity. Let them think about that late at night.
I think that's absolutely fair. I mean, the United States is breaking international law and traumatizing and abusing people. I think that's totally fair. And that maybe that's a movement that needs to get started.
It certainly would make them think.
It could, perhaps.
They're not practicing, but it might.
I wanted to thank you for your talk. It inspired some anger in me, not rageful anger, maybe, but anger about what's going on and my own lack of doing anything about it. Whether I'll follow through or not, I don't know, but I think anger at what's going on is needed. And yeah. Action taken from that.
Right.
Thanks.
And I think just, I think a lot of times we just get angry and it does the action part, and then that anger hurts us. It doesn't hurt them. It hurts us. I'm not sure I should talk about they and them, but it doesn't hurt the it doesn't help the situation, but it does hurt our hearts and souls. I truly believe that. And it's one reason that we get hopeless and that we get apathetic and just shut off, because we've turned in, and that's not going to help us feel better. Really believe that.
Thank you, Reverend Tracy.
So go forth with blazing love for yourselves and our beautiful world.